Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 18th. I'm Ray Graff. It's Astronomy Today. We welcome back Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson to talk about the heavens. And if you have a question about black holes or supernovae or whatever the plural is of that, give us a call. 800-348-2551. 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org with your astronomy question. It's Bob Berman, it's Valerie Rapson, it's you, it's the heavens. It comes up right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Two astronomers in the house today. They know a lot of things about the stars and the planets and the Milky Way and everything else. You got a question, call us, 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac, author of at least a dozen books, and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Dr. Valerie Rapson is assistant professor of physics and astronomy at SUNY Oneonta. She earned her Ph.D. in astrophysical science and technology at RIT. Again, if you have a question about astronomy, this is the time. 800-348-2551 is our number. 800-348-2551, or you can email us, voxpop@wamc.org. And just a tip, if you're going to email, and I say this on the medical shows and everything else, you know, if it's a really long, multisyllabic word, I have about a 2% chance of getting it right. So try to keep it really, you know, idiot-proof, and I'll do my best. Again, the number is 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Bob Berman, how are we?
Oh, great. Great, Ray. Good to be back.
Did I surprise you? Now you're getting your mic ready.
No, now the mic's ready. Yeah, there's okay. The mic. Yes. It's great to be back in the sunny Hudson Valley.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Was that a shot about the eclipse?
Yeah, we had such a close call down in Texas. You know, the group I was leading, we had thick clouds moving just around totality. I know nobody's going to say, oh, poor Bob. But fortunately, I mean, thank goodness, there's tiny breaks, and everyone saw moments of totality, and everybody was happy. And if they're happy, I'm happy. So that's
good.
The story.
So people enjoyed themselves. Yep. Valerie Rapson, you were gearing up at the college, and how did it go there?
Yeah, well, it was so much fun. We had over 3,000 students and community members join us. Yeah, probably the biggest crowd I've ever seen since I was there.
And it's like Woodstock.
Yeah, we're thrilled that it was science that brought them out,
yep,
right?
Really.
Concerts, sure, but science, it was really fun. And it was partly cloudy, but we did get to see the sun through the clouds. And at our maximum point of like 98% coverage, we did get to see the sun a little bit. And people were just excited to watch it get cold and a little bit dark, and it was really cool.
You know, as an educator, that has to thrill you, because across the country, people were going, they're really interested about this. My kids, my youngest kids who are still in public school, they went up with their classes to Tupper in a bus and saw the whole thing, and it was luckily clear, and they got to see everything. And, you know, 6.5 hours to get back. But still, I mean, it was well worth it. And then, yesterday we're doing the travel show on Vox Pop, and somebody wrote in about travel arrangements to Spain for 26, which is what? That's the next totality, right?
Mm-hmm. Yep, August 12th.
That's exciting.
So this is the last one in our area. We were just talking about that this is probably the major astronomical event in a 150-year period, because in upstate New York here, we last had a total eclipse on January 24th, 1925. Next one won't be till May 10th, 2079. That's over 150 years.
Well, there are plenty of astronomical events. For instance, and I know this may not be exciting to you professionals, but this business about this little, not supernova, but little nova that, did it happen yet? Are we able to
not
see it in the
I
sky?
Not that I have seen. I feel like it would have been all over my news feed yet, but it was a T. Corona Borealis. We're just like patiently waiting.
I can't wait.
Yeah, it's not as cool as, you know, a solar eclipse, and not as easy for everybody to see it, but definitely there'll be lots of other eclipses and cool things to see in the sky.
You sent me a couple of great articles, and this one is amazing. The largest digital camera ever made for astronomy is done.
Yeah, I'm kind of geeking out about this.
3,200. 100 megapixels.
Yeah,
try that on your iPhone.
It's huge. It's basically 186 little cameras all built together, and the actual diameter of the lens is 5 feet. So it's a camera that's the size of a human being.
Wow.
And they're attaching it to the 8.4 meter Vera Rubin Observatory. So
what do they hope to see?
Well, they're going to take pictures for like 10 years straight, literally in 6 colors, and they're going to have a movie of the entire night sky over 10 years' time that we'll just be able to watch. And we're going to see anything that changes in that time frame, we'll be able to detect. So it's literally kind of an all-science type of telescope.
Now, you know, we've talked about the Webb telescope and the Hubble telescope that are up there.
Sure.
This weighs 6,600 pounds, so I imagine it's quite a payload. But if you could get that thing up into space, imagine what you could see.
That and an equivalent-sized telescope up there would be our dream. So maybe when we actually do replace the Hubble, that's what we'll try and do, is something that big in space.
It's Astronomy Today on the program. Bob Berman is here and Valerie Rapson. 800-348-2551 is our telephone number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. The other one you sent from CNN, astronomers spot a massive sleeping giant black hole less than 2,000 light years from Earth. And now it's massive, but the one at the center of the Milky Way is hundreds of times bigger, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So what's the difference?
Yeah, so this is a stellar mass black hole, basically a massive star that died and the core collapsed and made a little black hole. And it's the closest, largest one that we have of this type of black hole. The supermassive one at the center is like 4 million solar masses. We're never going to find anything bigger than that in our galaxy.
Yeah.
But this one's exciting because they found it with Gaia, this telescope that is looking for slight motions of stars to measure their distance. And this star wiggled in a weird way, and we were actually able to figure out it was orbiting an unseen black hole.
Okay, and is this the same one that is basically a companion to a star that is still a very weak star that is still there, or am I thinking of another?
Yeah, so this is basically a little black hole that is still orbiting a visible star, and it was the actual star that was observed, and then we inferred the presence of the black hole with it. And it's a really cool star, like literally cold, it's small, and it's what we call low metallicity, which means it's been around for a long, long time, and it formed before other stars died and kind of enriched the region where this star would have formed.
And then Bob, the massive 4 million solar mass black hole at the center of the Milky Way, that was formed in a different way, right? That was not from a star per se, but something else?
Oh, right, because it's so massive, it wasn't one star. It was, you know, equal to 4 million suns. And it's not completely sure how something that mass, how black hole that massive forms. It's quite sure how a stellar mass black hole forms. You get an old star that's, let's say, 10, 12, 20 times heavier than the sun in its old age. Makes perfect sense it has to collapse. But something like what's at the center of the galaxy, you know, there's different ideas. How do you get that? It's not completely sure.
Mm-hmm. How many black holes do they reckon are actually in the Milky Way?
Oh, probably a lot.
Yeah.
We've literally only seen a handful because they're hard to detect. I mean, they're literally black holes. You can't point a telescope and see them in almost every case.
Yeah.
So you have to get lucky and see one that's orbiting another star. So there's probably a whole lot more that we just can't detect with our regular instrumentation, because they're not emitting light. There's nothing for us to see there.
You know, in that article from astronomy.com about the largest digital camera ever, one of the things they said they want to look at is this, what do they call it? The Einsteinian...
The Einstein cross.
No, not the cross. Lensing. So
they
want to look for lensing, and that's a way to find black holes too, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that's usually when you're looking at distant galaxies that have supermassive black holes, and it's the mass that is within that entire object that is bending light. If we had a nearby black hole that happened to pass in front of some distant bright stars, we could see some localized gravitational lensing. So yeah, that telescope might be able to pick something like that up.
All right, it's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The number is 800-348-2551. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And this one came in a while back from Robert. I will be in the Chena Hot Springs region of Alaska this July, metal detecting for gold nuggets during the day and watching the Aurora Borealis at night. Since the nights are only 4 hours long at that time of year, is there still a good chance for seeing an aurora, Bob?
No chance at all.
None?
None, zero.
just because the sun is still, the sky is bright, too bright?
Well, yeah, because he's 1 degree. Where he's going is 1 degree from the Arctic Circle. So in July, you're talking about, technically, it may not be daytime, but it's going to be twilight. And for the aurora, you need night. In fact, we don't even like moonlight for an aurora. So that's the wrong time of year to go there. But have fun. Chino's a great place.
You know, it's so funny. I wonder how long, and I know that astronomers and optical experts know the answer to this, but I do not. How long it takes your eyes to get settled and used to the dark. Here's why. Decades ago, my grandmother said, get out here. And we went out in the front yard, and there was a beautiful aurora with the shimmering curtains and everything else. Now, we had a pretty solid solar flare, or I don't know, maybe it was beyond that, last month. We went out. It was a clear night. I looked north, and, you know, I said, I think I'm seeing something. But I wonder how many minutes, how long does it take your eyes to acclimate to the dark?
Well, scotopic vision, caused by the rod-shaped cells, of which we have 120 million of them in our retinas, one of the its five major flaws is that it's very slow to get going. It needs these cells need repeated stimulation to get going at all. And that's why if you turn off your main lights at night in your bedroom so that there's only a night light, first, everything looks pitch black.
Yeah.
And then over the next 5 minutes, you slowly start seeing detail. After 5 minutes, you're seeing... You're starting to see stuff, but it's 20 minutes before you can really see everything you're going to see. So that's called dark adaptation, and we as astronomers are used to that. It makes makes us strange on dates, but we're used to it.
I'm not surprised. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. We'll be back. Soul Talk there. Johnny Hammond Smith here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. Email is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get back to the emails. I'll tell you, Robert added a sentence here. With remember, I put the caveat out there, please try to make the words easy to say. He also wrote, also, do you have any information relating to the theory that gold actually has its origin in magnetorotational hypernova? What the heck? What is that? I don't even know what that is.
And Bob immediately looks at me like, you know big science words. Yeah. You're a PhD. You could do this.
Magnetorotational hypernovae. All right. So do we even know what that is?
I mean, I'm not super familiar with that theory in particular, but I do know, like, you know, we talked about novas and supernovas in the past. You know, anytime a supernova goes off, you'll get these heavy metals. And collisions of neutron stars recently were shown to be able to produce a lot more gold than we thought they did. So I always, like, you know, look at my jewelry and think, you know, that really is stardust on my finger.
Looking at the stars the other day, and I, you know, you always go back to that Joni Mitchell line, we are stardust.
Mm-hmm.
And really, it's what we're made of. Yeah.
Yeah.
Didn't you write a couple books about that, Bob?
Well, yeah, that's almost a cliche. I can't be proud of that because it may have been Carl Sagan who said it first, but
probably.
I mean, it's true.
Yeah. Why, were you not a fan of Carl Sagan's?
Oh, yeah, sure. You're hard not to like him. He was really a humanist.
Oh, and that's good.
Well, isn't it, to care about the human race?
It is. Mm-hmm. It is. It's fine. Let's go to the phones. 800-348-2551. Peter's in Warwick. Peter, you're on.
Hey, Valerie, Bob, and...
Ray.
There are so many shows on TV that deal with extraterrestrials. Your own feeling about that? You know, some purport to show evidence, some speculate. What are your thoughts?
Well, I'll jump in and say that I'm always very skeptical. I mean, first, I think it's great that we're popularizing it, that we are trying to scientifically think about it and do what scientists do, find evidence, come up with theories and all of that. But nothing I've seen on those shows, and I've watched a whole bunch of them, nothing has been like blown me away like, oh my gosh, I can't believe we didn't know that. And honestly, I don't think a special on a TV channel is really going to be the first place that we announce that aliens have been discovered. So I remain skeptical, but I think it's great that we're thinking about this in a scientific way.
Bob.
Well, now that we've discovered amino acids and the cracks in asteroids, and it's not far-fetched that you can get the building blocks of life from drifting through space that maybe falls on various planets and then starts sprouting and developing and evolving if conditions are right. So logically, there should be life. But, because I like to get far out about these things, I still go back a whole century to the quantum theory guys who said that the whole universe is basically conscious. And therefore, when you're looking for life, that's the, like, fish in the ocean saying, oh, where's the ocean? We don't see it. It could be that this is like a universal, that in some sense that it's all alive or all conscious. But that's sort of being a wise guy. I know what everyone's talking about. They're talking about on the surface or perhaps underwater in liquids around the universe. Are there organisms that are maybe a little like us?
But you know, Peter, thanks for that. And now you know what you've done. We appreciate you opening that can of worms. I saw an article, I think it was at space.com, about what's that moon of Saturn that looks like the Death Star in Star Wars?
Enceladus?
Yeah, okay.
Well, Iapetus.
Mimas is the one with the big crater.
Yeah,
but Enceladus is the one with the water, where the aliens might be.
Well, that's interesting, and I did not print this article, but there was some talk about perhaps this moon, and I don't know why, but some collision or whatever that caused that may have left, and because of its proximity to Saturn, left actual underground water in that moon. I mean, isn't that cool?
Yeah, it's really awesome. I mean, there's a couple of moons out there that we think have like a couple mile deep liquid water oceans, and we see the cryovolcanism. We actually see it spitting water and ice crystals into space, so we know these oceans have to be there. Our next step is to send the spacecrafts that can sample the water and really look for the signs of life.
If they'll do that, but they're not talking about doing that yet. It's just so frustrating. The first, of course, was Europa, as you know, around Jupiter.
And is that the one that shoots out geysers?
Europa doesn't, but you can actually see cracks in the ice where water has bubbled up and then refrozen. And spacecrafts have detected sodium ions and atoms above Europa. So we're talking about salt water, and it's water. It's not solid. Why is it water? Because of the weird fact that the Jupiter moons march like a marching band, with Io going around four times to the second in exactly the same time that Europa goes around twice and Ganymede goes around once, which means they keep meeting up and pulling on each other tidally, stretching each other out and producing heat within those bodies. So that's why you got nice, warm saltwater oceans in Europa. And boy, if you're going to look for life, why go twice as far away to Saturn? You know, start there.
Okay.
But the European Space Agency, they are still planning to send a orbiter. And people like you and me and Valerie are saying, an orbiter? Don't we want to drill or burn away through the ice and see, you know, what, if anything, is swimming down there? What an orbiter?
You don't want to do that, though,
right? Don't waste our time with an orbiter.
Why would you do that, though? Isn't that the prime directive? You don't want to cause any harm? I mean, if you're drilling in there, isn't that going to possibly change any ecosystem that's in
there? You'll use a sterile drill bit.
Really?
Well, shouldn't it be?
Well, I don't know. You're the one who said that there were some bacteria that survived on the space the moon
shots.
Yeah,
but we don't want to send them. We already did that with the Surveyor craft on the moon. Remember, 2.5 years later, when we had the first Apollo, that is Apollo 12, and the astronauts hopped over to it, there was a living streptococcus in the foam of the Surveyor lander that had lived for 2 years in that plus 200 degrees at day, minus 200 degrees at night, no air conditions. And if you ever wondered why it's so hard to get rid of a strep throat.
Seriously.
I mean, my goodness.
You can't even go to the moon to get away from it.
So let's not do that again. Now, of course, if we go to Jupiter, we're not going to send a filthy COVID-covered drill bit down drilling through the ice.
Okay. We agree on that. Let's go to Barbara in Armenia. Barbara, you're on. Hi, Barbara. Can you turn your radio down, my friend, a wee bit? Oh, Barbara, it's not going well, my friend. Hello, Barbara. Zach, the engineer, is having a coronary. Okay. Bye-bye, Barbara. Call us again. Turn your radio down. Sorry, Zach. Let's go to Troy. Bob, you're on.
Hey, guys.
Hey.
We can look around us and see the redshift of the galaxies moving away from us, or we're moving away from them. And we can see the three-degree cosmic background and whatnot. But from this, can we infer the shape of the universe, or the shape it's expanding in since the Big Bang?
Well, we need to get a little bit bigger to be able to understand the full shape of the universe. Because even when we're seeing all of those galaxies and things moving away from us, it kind of gives us the false sense that everything is spherical, right? You know, you're moving away in all directions.
Right.
But when you're really small, you see that kind of spherical curvature. But on much larger scales, the universe seems to be flat. And that comes more from theories and distant observations of galaxies and things like that.
Go ahead, Bob. Bob, not in Troy.
Obviously, we're not in Troy.
Yeah, the Bob Berman.
Bob in the studio. You go first, and then Bob and Troy,
you go. In 2012, out in California at Berkeley, they did a survey of 900,000 galaxies to show that flat topology that you just talked about, Ray, to show the basics of the universe. So that's true. But I want to introduce a thought here. When we're talking about the universe, we're talking about everything. So can everything have a shape? To have a shape, there would have to be an outside to it to define the shape. Mm-hmm. Wouldn't there be? I'm not saying I'm sure about this. I'm sort of just winging this here. But if the discussion is everything, can everything have a particular shape?
What do you think, Bob and Troy? You want to tackle that one for us?
Exactly.
What do you think?
From the philosophical perspective. I was thinking, you know, obviously, universe. So do we have some idea of where in it we are? And that led to what shape is it?
Okay.
Yeah, that's easier. That's an easier one.
Okay, where are we?
Because since everything was equally created at the Big Bang, and as Valerie and I have said many times, it happened right here, the Big Bang, and everyone in the universe can make that same statement that it happened right here. The best everyone could do is say, here is the center of the universe. And I know that's true because everything is expanding away from me, and they'd all be right. And how could everyone be right when they say they're at the center of the universe? But you know what? They are. So go back and think about that one.
All right, Bob. Thanks a lot for the call. 800-348-2551. Interesting, Bob Berman. You said, Ray, you mentioned flat topology. I didn't. I thought it. Are you psychic? I did not. I didn't get to it because Bob and Troy was talking.
Because we're hanging out so much.
That is so interesting because I was going to bring that up, and then you it's very weird. I got to get out of here. Elizabeth in New Paltz, you're on.
Hello?
Hello.
Yeah. I have two things that I learned about dark adaptation.
Okay.
One is that if you're going to an astronomy viewing event, it's impolite to come late when you have your lights on because your headlights can ruin everybody's dark adaptation. That's one. And secondly, that even the cheapest headlamps have a red light feature on it, because if you use the red light feature instead of the regular light, that doesn't ruin the dark adaptation.
You guys agree?
Yeah, we agree. We agree.
Yeah, definitely. I was always that person at star parties that would get really grumpy at the cars with the headlights coming in, and I was not shy about going over and being, can you turn them off, please? You're killing our night vision here.
But that's not even the worst offense. This a few months ago during our Aurora tour up in Alaska, there were people aiming their cameras at the Aurora with flash cameras while everyone else's eyes are dark adapted.
Yeah,
this flash is going
Where was
off.
This? Down in Texas?
No, this is up in Alaska.
Oh, I was going to say.
But it would be an equal offense in Texas.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Elizabeth. 800-348-2551 is our number. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. And it's astronomy today. Grace in Sheffield writes, hi, I'm Grace in Sheffield. Okay, so established. In the bottom left-hand corner of Massachusetts, where Massachusetts, New York, and Connecticut meet. That's where Sheffield is. The eclipse was high up to the southwest. The bright crescent at 94% here was at the bottom of the sun as we looked at it. Question, if I were in Canada, on the other side of the line of the total eclipse, would the bright crescent have been at the top of the sun as we looked at it?
Yeah, it would have been on the other side, because you would have been on the other side of the just missing totality, yes.
Interesting. Yeah.
It's all about the angle that you're looking at it from, where the moon and the sun are kind of combining together in your perspective. You're kind of looking, as Bob said, from the other side of the triangle, and you would see it at the top instead
That's
of the
so
bottom.
That's so cool. And Grace goes on, it got cold here during the eclipse. The birds sang and the mosquitoes came out.
Mm.
Yikes.
No, that's why you try to avoid total eclipses. All those mosquitoes. You don't want to be around them.
All right. Andy writes in, on a recent trip to the Big Island of Hawaii, I was fortunate to make a trip up Mauna Kea and witness the sunset from 14,000 feet up, and then partake in a live observatory discussion at the visitor center with our guide pointing out constellations with her laser pointer. Can you explain why the Big Dipper was upside down for us Northeasterners? Were other constellations upside down too? And that's from Andy.
Well, Mauna Kea is the only, well, Hawaii is the only state that's in the tropics of all the American states. So you're actually south of the Tropic of Cancer. And so you're seeing things from a different angle. Everything is shifted from there. So, but beyond that, the Dipper has a different orientation at different times of the year. As it seems to orbit around the North Star Polaris, it changes its orientation. Like at some times of the year, it looks like it'll pour water onto Leo. At other times, there's no way it's going to pour water onto anything. So there's that also. So there's a few factors going on there.
Yeah, right now in early spring, if I'm remembering correctly, the Dipper's kind of hanging upside down high in the northeastern sky. But go back again in fall, and it's going to be around. Around, you know, half the circle kind of at the bottom, looking more like that classic spoon shape that we look for.
I love it when it's upside down. I like looking over from my backyard up over my house and just seeing it hanging right over the top of the house.
Mm-hmm.
These are the things that the ancients must have gone crazy over, you know?
They had nothing else to do except sit there, make stories, look at the stars. I mean, yeah.
But they built these magnificent, not monuments, but these stone circles and whatever that have astronomical alignments. It blows my mind. When is the first recorded eclipse that was predictable, that was predicted by the ancients? They did that for thousands of years, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's such a great question. I'm gonna have to look that up. That's good.
Number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The email address is voxpop@wamc.org. We'll get back to the email bag in a little bit. Let's go to Larry in New Paltz. Hello, Larry.
Hello there. Thanks for taking my call.
Yep.
I've got a question about the possibility of using the magnetic field of the sun as a mechanism for traveling around the solar system between planets. If one were to construct a magnet, like with a large coil out in space, some place between Earth and Mars, say, you could, you know, choose to orient the field in a particular way. And I'm wondering if that would be strong enough to be able to align with the magnetic field of the sun to either produce a attraction or repulsion. Now, I realize that that's not a particularly stable system, so you'd have to continually adjust it. But just curious, what do you think?
Well, it's not strong enough is the problem to propel you. It's like taking your refrigerator magnet off your fridge, and then having another magnet of the opposite polarity in your pocket and seeing if you could drive yourself, if you're on roller skates, see if you could propel yourself to down to the local grocery store. It's just not a strong enough magnetic field to work like that.
Yeah, I was just checking on my phone too, like, you know, trying to compare it to the Earth because I didn't remember the numbers. But yeah, the at the surface of the sun, the magnetic field strength is not all that different from what we would experience near the surface of the Earth. So
wow.
You'd really have to find something more powerful to be able to do that. I mean, the gravity of the sun is a much better slingshot mechanism than I think trying to use the magnetic field would be.
Hey, solar wind, too, right? You could use that. You could put a sail up and
as
do
a
that.
Sail. Yeah. Let's talk about that. Yeah.
All right, Larry, we got to take a break here, but thank you, sir. 800-348-2551 is our number. It's Vox Pop. It's Astronomy with Dr. Valerie Rapson and Bob Berman. We'll be back. John Schofield here on Vox Pop. 800-348-2551 is the number. 800-348-2551. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. Dr. Valerie Rapson is here from SUNY Oneonta. And Bob Berman is here from the center of the universe or wherever.
Willow, New York.
Willow, New York. There you are. Number, once again, is 800-348-2551. Did I see somewhere that there is a minor meteor shower happening soon?
You know, I deliberately, as the astronomy editor of the Old Farmer's Almanac, we are compelled to put in all sky events, including meteor showers. Mm-hmm. But when I took over that job about 30, 35 years ago, I decided, first of all, no more penumbral lunar eclipses. We're not going to mention it anymore. And another one is forget the minor meteor showers, mm-hmm. because there's just a couple of extra shooting stars per hour. And we don't want people to go out and be disappointed and say,
you
got to
fill pages in the magazine. What are you doing?
Well, so you know, the Geminids every December 13th, the Perseids every August 11th, once every 33 years, the Leonids, mm-hmm. you know, on November mm-hmm. 18th. But the minor showers, I don't keep track of them.
Well, speaking of things falling from the sky, did you see that poor house that got hit by part of the space station?
Yes. Yeah. What part was it?
Florida, right?
Yeah.
Some part of an old battery or something. I mean, the intention is always when this material falls to Earth that it burns up, right? But this must have been a small chunk that just didn't quite burn up and it crashed through somebody's house.
And NASA admitted it recently. But, I mean, as we go forth and more satellites are going up, more satellites get old, more satellites destabilize in their mm-hmm. orbit. This is going to happen more and more, isn't it?
Definitely. I just went to a cool lecture by an economist who's trying to figure out, you know, what to do about this and how do we get companies on board to try not to make space junk that's up there and come up with like real legitimate plans for either deorbiting or getting rid of their satellites when they're dead. Because with all these satellite constellations, there's going to be hundreds of thousands of satellites, and we need a plan for when they no longer function, what do we do with them? You can't just leave them up there. They don't want to be space junk.
It is Astronomy Today with Valerie Rapson at Bob Berman. The number is 800-348-2551. Tom writes in, is Bob doing an eclipse trip to Spain in 26?
Yes, thanks for the...
Are you really?
Yes, just look at Bob Berman Tours, and you'll find out the information.
So you're going to Spain?
Yeah, it'll be posted certainly by the weekend, if not by this afternoon.
That's amazing. Yeah.
Everybody's excited. You should get it up there soon. I keep seeing people going, when's the next one? When's the next one? I feel like we got so many people hooked in this country.
Yeah, we've suddenly got millions more people.
Isn't that great, though?
Yeah, it is so cool.
It's great.
Here's a question from Alan Newberg at voxpop@wamc.org. That's the email. The number is 800-348-2551. Al in Newberg writes, are all planets spherical in shape or is it only the Earth and why?
The short answer is yes, for sure. Technically, their oblate spheroids are a little bit squished because they're spinning, so their centers are a little bit squished. And some of the dwarf planets and smaller objects, they have funny shapes. There's some that are more egg-shaped or oval-shaped, again, because they're rapidly rotating and they're maybe not as solid as a regular planet would be. But yes, everything is spherical, and that's because of gravity. Gravity's pulling equally in all directions, so if you've got material that's collecting together, it's going to pull you into a spherical shape.
Interesting. Bob, so it has to spin? It has to be a certain mass?
Well, we don't know anything that's not spinning.
Well, what about asteroids?
Yeah, they spin.
I've seen asteroids that look like potatoes and everything else.
Are we talking about spin or shape?
We're talking about shape here.
Oh, well, if it's shape, yes. As Valerie said, you need a certain mass.
Okay.
I'm not going to go there.
Okay.
You need a certain mass to have self-gravity to pull yourself in when you're when you're born and you're liquidy to pull you into the smallest possible volume, and that's always a sphere. But if you lack that, if you're just too wimpy in mass, then you can be any shape.
Yeah.
So that's why, as she said, asteroids and space junk and the smaller moons in the solar system, some of the little ones that are 30 or 80 miles across can escape being round. But everything, even Pluto, as small as it is mass-wise, is round, perfectly round.
Mm-hmm. The number here is 800-348-2551. It's Astronomy Today with Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson. The email is voxpop@wamc.org. This is from Justin in Cornwallville. What is the solar wind? Isn't there no air up there?
It's broken bits of atoms, really. Valerie and I would use the word plasma and say that's the fourth state of matter. You've got solid, liquid, gas, and plasma. And all plasma is it's not atoms that are separate, but broken pieces of atoms, like electrons and protons and neutrons. And that's just a fancy word of saying broken. So that's what that is. The solar wind the sun is, and this was Eugene Parker in the 1950s who first proposed that. He said, well, why do you think comet tails always point away from the sun, like airport windsocks? And he gave logical reasons. And in the great tradition of science, he was ridiculed.
Yeah.
And people said, oh, yeah, right, sure, a wind coming off the sun. Yeah,
yeah,
right, sure. But he was right.
Yeah, it seems so obvious now. Like, I wonder what else is screaming in our face about the universe that we are just missing, right? Because that windsock example is perfect. You see that here on Earth because of the wind. Why not bring that analogy into space and try and see if you can prove it?
Here on Earth, terrestrial air winds, you can get gusts and you can have hurricane and gale force winds. Mm-hmm. Is the solar wind a constant velocity?
So it's roughly constant at most times. But when the sun is more active, you will see flares and things that can accelerate the solar wind a little bit. So a solar flare it's not just accelerated solar wind, it's extra plasma that gets tossed away. But there are mechanisms that can push it a little bit further and a little bit faster. So it does change, but there is always a constant blowing wind from the magnetic field that's leaving the sun all the time.
Which averages about 300 miles a second.
Wow. Okay, and so these solar sails that they have proposed, I don't know if anybody's actually done it yet. Have they done it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. They've tested them. They work really well as long as the spacecraft is low mass, right? Because you can't push a heavy thing with light, but you can push small things with light.
And they were talking about these micro sats with sails going across the galaxy, basically. Mm-hmm. And I think it's cool, but it must take quite a bit of time to get up to any kind of speed approaching.
You wonder if it's going to be funded. Just look at the manned Martian landings. I'm old enough, unfortunately, to remember that when we had our final Apollo landing, in December of 72.
Two, really?
All the science writers, including it was even myself at that time, were predicting that we'll certainly be landing on Mars by the end of the next decade, which means the late 80s. In other words, roughly 15 years in the future. When that time came, it was now predicted to be around 2000, also 15 years in the future. What are they saying nowadays? NASA's saying the late 2030s, 15 years in the future. It's always 15 years in the future.
Well, they did land the Viking in 76. And you're the
good for you.
You're the
but
one
you
who
remember that. That's
I watched it.
Oh, that was such a great space.
12 years old.
They landed on the 4th
it.
Of July on our anniversary date.
On your anniversary date?
No. The country.
Oh,
our collective.
Right.
What wonderful craft they were that took a soil sample and analyzed it to see if there was possible signs of life.
There's a conspiracy on that, though.
There's
a conspiracy on that. I guarantee you. When I watched it, I was excited. I watched as much as you could see. The camera's looking on Mars, and at one point, it shows a rock that had a beautifully formed letter F. As beautiful as could be, they cut away, and it was never talked about. They talked about it briefly, and then never mentioned again. And so it was said, oh, well, it's a mineral deposit. Can you have right angles like that and mineral deposits
if
and
it's
letters?
Maybe if it's fluorine.
Fluorine?
Get it, the F, fluorine.
Okay. All right. Richard's in Rensselaer. Richard, you're on.
Yes, I'd like to know, during the total eclipse, there was a small bright object below and a bit to the right of it. Would you know what that was?
That was a prominence. This is the thing that made this eclipse so special, the totality, was we had the brightest of the eclipses that I've been seeing going back 54 years. This had the most spectacular naked eye prominences. So those, anyone at totality saw brilliant pink spots. Yeah. For most places, it was on the lower right of the sun, but depending upon where you were, as the sun moved across the sky, it could have been at the bottom or even slightly the 7 o'clock position.
Did and Richard were... see totality, though? Don't you have to have totality?
Yes,
to see
you
that?
Do.
Richard, where were you watching?
I was in Vermont.
Okay, you saw
West
it then.
Addison.
Okay, go ahead, Bob.
Yeah. So you saw the prominences. Usually you want binoculars during totality to bring them out because they're so tiny often that they don't see them clearly. But this eclipse, boy, they were right in your face. There were three of them, but one in particular, the one that you're talking about, caller, on the bottom, was really huge and brilliant.
Uh-huh. There you go.
So good for you.
Thanks, Richard. I don't know if you heard it. You probably didn't. You were in Texas. And Valerie, you were busy at the college. But Ian Pickus and Sarah LaDuke did a tremendous live broadcast from Tupper, during the eclipse. And it was actually great radio. When they proposed it, I said, how are you going to do that? It's a visual thing.
Right.
But it was a spectacular show. And while the totality was happening, there was a, I forget the guy's name, he was on with them, and he said, there's the diamond. What was the diamond? Is that the same thing you were talking about?
Well, no, that's not a prominence. That's one last bit of full sunlight that shines through some lunar valley just before or just after totality. There's controversy over whether it's safe to look at because it is a spot of full sunlight. And usually the ongoing... from the cognoscenti for this kind of thing is take a quick glance at it because you don't want to miss it, but no more than that because you don't want the heat to build up in your eye and do any eye damage. So, yeah, the diamond ring was another spot, but it wasn't pink. That one was, like, not just white, but brilliant.
Yeah, you know, I had an ophthalmologist on, I think it was beginning of, what day is today, Thursday? So I think it was Monday of this week. And he said, yeah, we haven't seen anybody with any eye damage from that yet. So that was pretty good.
That's good.
We scare them.
Yeah, I think we've done enough safety trainings and PSAs online of like, please don't look at the sun. Make sure your glasses are good. And most people were safe. So,
well, that's good. And those glasses now, there was some debate about it. Do they have a shelf life? Otherwise, I'm going to save them.
Oh, yeah, save it. They're good forever.
Yeah, I mean, as long as they were, you know, purchased recently with all the new standards, they're good. Although I do want to say if people don't want to keep them or think they're just going to lose them, you can recycle them. You can send them back to many of the eclipse glasses companies. We're collecting them at the Science Center, and we're going to ship them to South America
for students that
are unable to purchase their own. So they'll get recycled and used for kids who wouldn't otherwise get to watch
the
eclipse.
And let's repeat what we said last time, which is if you're using the floppy kind, don't keep them in a pocket or in a drawer that has sharp objects like keys or pins or something because you don't want to scratch the coating on those. That would be bad.
Just take
care of them.
I've really enjoyed. I mean, we went up on the roof here and saw as much as we could see, which I don't know, what was it, 96% here or something in Albany. But I've enjoyed those glasses more just looking at the sun when it's out. Because you don't really look at the sun too often, and when you do, it's this brilliant star. But when you put those on, it's just this orange ball, and it's really cool to see. If there were prominent sunspots, would I be able to see them?
If they're big enough, yes. Yeah.
Larger than Earth would show up to the naked eye.
Yep. And we're approaching solar maximum, so I would encourage people to hang on to the glasses at least for the next couple of years because there might be some really large sunspots that you would just be able to see on any given day by looking at the sun with the glasses.
Very cool. And there's no time limit? In other words, if I put them on and I have them on and they don't fall off my head, I can look at the sun for as long as I want?
They're good. That standard that we mentioned last week, the official standard, SOR 12312-2, means that you can look at the sun for 26 straight hours.
Okay. Well, I'm not going to do that. No, not at all.
It's a little intense.
That's very, very true. I was seeing, was it in that article here, Valerie, that you sent about the sleeping giant black hole? No, it must have been another one about a gas giant that had aurora, which is not uncommon on Jupiter
and such.
But this was not around that. It was not near a star. It was near a dwarf star.
Yeah, so I think it was a brown dwarf.
Okay, that's what it was.
Yeah, I saw this. So they're trying to figure out. So we just talked about the solar wind and stuff, right? So the solar wind, when it hits our planet, when it hits Jupiter in particular, the material gets funneled to the poles and it can create the aurora.
Same as here.
But if you don't have a star, how do you get aurora? So they found this brown dwarf that is like a failed star slash really big planet that isn't orbiting a star, and they can see aurora with the James Webb Space Telescope. They can pick up signatures of it. So they're thinking that there's an exomoon, a moon orbiting this object that is actually spitting out particles that are getting funneled to the poles and generating aurora without the need of a star.
And so it would be similar to the moon of, I guess, is it Saturn or Jupiter that has geysers of water that spit out? Is that what they're talking about?
Well, Saturn has one of those, and it makes like the E ring around Saturn. But it's more similar to Io, which orbits Jupiter. And that the particles basically come off of Io. They get funneled into this torus and then sent to the poles of Jupiter. So if you have a relatively large and close moon to the planet, you can create aurora without a star.
I didn't realize that auroras have something to do with the production of methane. Is that correct?
So I think what they were seeing is that there's methane in the atmosphere of the planet. And then the fact that the auroras were being caused, it's the particles coming through the methane and causing it to be illuminated. Because that's what they saw, was the glowing methane.
Understood. All right, Valerie Rapson, what is going on over at the planetarium and at the observatory and everything else over at Oneonta?
Yeah, we've got planetarium shows every Saturday through the end of the semester. And we're going to continue Saturday shows through the summer. So check out our website, and we'll have some new shows offered different ones so people can come all summer long and enjoy it.
Now, when these, I haven't been to a planetarium in probably 30 years or more. It's all computerized now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
yes.
So how do you have a map of everything that's out there that's accurate?
Well, we do the best we can with all those telescopes. I mean, even the one, the Gaia, that picked up this this black hole is literally doing that. It's mapping the sky and giving us the three-dimensional view. So the data keeps getting funneled in. We keep updating the software, and it literally shows where all the stars are.
Here's what I want, and I was thinking about this today. And this might already exist.
Okay.
Virtual reality. Where you are in space, I'd love to travel in space, but I think it's a little expensive. All right, so, but you could travel and go through at near speed of light and go through the universe or faster and see all these galaxies and have everything else be in position regardless of which way you are. Is the computing technology enough for that yet?
They're working on it.
Yeah?
I don't remember all the details, but I remember hearing about a demo of some new software that can do that. So I think it's just on the horizon that we'll be able to do kind of realistic planetarium shows, but in virtual reality headsets.
So cool. Bob Berman, what's happening with you? What's going on? What's coming up next?
Well, other than the prep for both Egypt in 27, that'll be the longest eclipse of the century for the remainder of the century,
really?
And Spain in 26, both of them in August. So we have websites up for that again on, can I, Bob
yes,
Berman,
say it.
Bob Berman Tours.
So you're going to Egypt. Are you going to be by the Sphinx and the pyramids and everything?
Well, here's the thing. Because you'd never know whether it's a time of turmoil in the Middle East or not, what we plan to do is have the group isolated from the rest of the country, be in a dark place, and I'm not supposed to give out the details from that, but we're going to have a second group also going to Morocco for that one.
Oh, neat.
It'll
now,
also be total.
Fun.
Do you need a security clearance at all to go on any of these?
I don't think so, but I'd sure like you to come.
I will probably watch it on TV.
With the kids.
All right. Well, let's leave it there. Support comes from Ambrose Electric Standby Power, an electrical contractor providing sales service and installation of residential and commercial Generac automatic standby generators, serving the Greater Capital District for over 40 years. AmbroseLEC.com. And Orthopedic Associates of Dutchess County, orthopedic and spine specialists with Ortho Express walk-in centers in Poughkeepsie, Kingston, East Fishkill, at New Windsor, OrthoADC.com to learn more. Once again, thanks to Bob Berman and Valerie Rapson for being here today. Thanks for listening. Thanks for the calls. Thanks for the emails. Thanks to Zach Malloy, our stellar engineer. See what I did there? He's a stellar engineer. And who screened the calls? Susie Checkeye, of course. I didn't forget. I'm just senile. Tomorrow it's Food Friday, and our friend, Jennifer Clare will be here. We'll get some kitchen hacks. We'll see you tomorrow at 2:00.